Now we come to verse 11. For behold, the Lord commandeth, and he will smite the great house with breaches, and the little house with clefts. High and low, great and small, are going to be affected by this when the Assyrian comes down and takes them into captivity. And verse 12, shall horses run upon the rock? Well, if you've ever ridden horseback in a mountain country where there's a great deal of rock, you know a horse can slip and fall. Among the many things that I did as a young fella, I belonged to the National Guard and to the cavalry. That's the horse cavalry. And we were out on patrol duty, and I was riding a big, tall, red horse, and the section I patrolled was very rocky. It was up in Middle Tennessee, and my horse slipped out from in under me, not necessarily from in under me, but because I went right down with the horse, and he fell on the side of one of my feet, and as a result, why, it got me off of patrol duty, and I was actually sent back home because they didn't want me hanging around. And I never regretted that because it got me out of a great deal of hard work. Very frankly, and probably I'd ended up peeling potatoes, but I got out of it because of that. And I always appreciated that old red horse. But this is the same thing. Shall horses run upon the rock? Well, they better not. They'll slip and fall. Will one plow there with oxen? You can run a plow over a rock. For ye have turned justice into gall, and the fruit of righteousness into hemlock. In other words, you've done that which is contrary to reason, that which is contrary to that which is right, and that which is righteousness. That is the thing that he's saying to him. In other words, you've acted very foolish, as foolish as I was, and maybe not so foolish, in riding that old red horse over that rocky terrain. Now, verse 13, ye who rejoice in a thing of nothing, who say, have we not taken to us horns by our own strength? Now, they've taken nothing. Actually, both the Old and the New Testament treat idols as nothing. But the very interesting thing that they recognize that back of idols there are demons. The Greeks were probably as intelligent a people as ever been upon this earth. And for a period of time, there was a glory that was Greece. It manifested itself in many ways. And one, of course, was intellectual. They were highly sophisticated and intellectual people during that particular period. Now, they worshipped idols. You remember Paul. He says, why, you've got so many of them that you even made an idol to the unknown God. They were an intelligent people, but they worship idols. And somebody says, well, it's nothing to an idol. Why in the world would an intelligent people do that? Don't you believe that the Greeks worship nothing? The idol's nothing, but back of the idol was a demon. And I will go along today with many of these people who are in cults who tell me that some remarkable things take place in the cult. I'll go along with you and say the remarkable thing takes place, but who done it? That's my question. Who done it? And the one that did it, I'm confident, is Satan, and demonism is back of a great deal of this today. Now, let me move on down, verse 14. But behold, I'll raise up against you a nation, O house of Israel, saith the Lord, the God of hosts, and they shall afflict you from the entrance of Hamath, that is all the way up into Syria, this was the chief city, under the river of the Arabah. And that, of course, is the river that was on the other side of Jordan River. In fact, it flowed into the Dead Sea. So that God says, through the whole extent of your land, this enemy is coming down from the north. And that enemy was not Ben-Hadad of Syria, but it was the king of Assyria. And he took these people into captivity.